We have the top stories of the week from Physicians First Watch, followed by a conversation about where we die now in the United States. Here's Amy Herman with the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. In a large meta-analysis, researchers compared five management strategies for dyspepsia. These were 1. Prompt endoscopy, 2. Test for H. pylori, followed by endoscopy after positive findings, 3. Test and treat for H. pylori, 4. Empirical acid suppression, and 5. Symptom-based management. Although no method was clearly better than another, test and treat did seem most effective. Next, in an observational study, low-dose aspirin did not prevent primary cardiovascular events in Black adults, even in those who were considered to be at high risk. And among white patients, there was only a non-significant trend toward a benefit. Elsewhere, an analysis finds that upping the recommended age range for a so-called catch-up HPV vaccination to age 45 would only slightly lower rates of HPV-associated disease, but it would greatly increase cost. Currently, the CDC encourages catch-up vaccination only through age 26. And finally, the U.S. flu season has gotten its earliest start in 15 years, and the South is being hit particularly hard. The B strain of the virus has made an early appearance. Usually it shows up around March or April. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
For the first time in close to a century, Americans are more likely to die at home than anywhere else. The shift was noted in a letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine by our guest, Dr. Haider Warreich. Warreich and a colleague, Sarah Cross, who researches public policy at Duke, looked at U.S. national death statistics. They note that home deaths in the U.S. increased from about 24% in 2003 to about 31% in 2017. Hospital deaths, on the other hand, dropped from about 40% in 2003 to about 30% in 2017. But that's enough numbers. Let me introduce Dr. Warreich, who is a cardiologist at the Boston Veterans Affairs Hospital, an associate physician at Brigham and Women's, and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. His clinical research focuses on end-of-life care for patients with heart disease. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Warreich.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
I guess I should also mention you're an author as well as all the other things I mentioned at the outset. And your latest book, I think, is The Modern Death. Is that right?
Yes, Modern Death was a book I wrote that came out in 2017. And I actually just had a more recent book called State of the Heart that came out this summer. But Modern Death really laid down the foundation for not only my interest in the medical humanities, but also my research, and is actually very closely linked to this paper as well.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, as I was getting interested in doing an interview with you, I got myself a copy of Modern Death, and I have to say that your review of how cells die at the very beginning of the book was a nice review. But there are plenty of numbers to talk about here. But let's focus on the cultural meaning of the shift that's been identified and deaths from hospitals to deaths at home. And the deaths at home have just edged past those in hospitals. What are the implications of that?
There are many implications, but, you know, I first focus on the patient. And, you know, as a clinician, like, you know, many of the listeners, there are so many patients I see almost on a daily basis who are, you know, facing off a serious illness or are at the end of life. And many of them have just one wish, that they want to die at home, even if it's just for a day. For some patients, even if they can be at home for the last day of their life, that is a goal worth striving for. And the studies suggest that that's true overall, that the vast majority of people, both in this country as well as others, would like to die at home. So the fact that we're seeing more people die at home is a positive development from that point of view, because, you know, if you look at history, this is really how we have died throughout our entire history as a species. And it has only been this last century that really saw deaths become hospitalized, so to speak, and really I think was at odds with the sort of epigenetic memory that we've had and the sort of expectation or experience we've had with end of life since primordial time. So to see that reverse is something that, you know, I was heartened to see, but I think that there's also another side of it. The other reason why I think it's important is because, you know, we've, now that more people are dying at home, the question is, well, are we doing a good enough job of supporting them and their caregivers? And traditionally, so many of our services and supports have focused on the hospital. And even today, unless you read this paper, most people will presume that most Americans die in institutions such as nursing homes or hospitals. So I think what this paper does is that it forces us to think about, well, it's good that more people are able to die in a place that they would wish to, but are we doing a good enough job of supporting them is a big question.
Yes. And one of the questions I had was, does this mean that there will be more of a need for clinicians to be making those home care calls than has heretofore been necessary?
I think that's part of this, that's definitely a model that I think needs to be, you know, revived in some way. Again, you know, this is something that, you know, physicians used to do, in the past. And I certainly think that as we move forward and patients want to receive care where they are, whether that involves telehealth visits, seeing your, you know, talking to your physician as we are doing right now on Skype, or some other sort of new technology-based platform, or whether it's in-person visits, I think that has to be something that has to be seriously considered, because, you know, one of the things that happens when someone dies at home is that we've essentially changed over the responsibility of their primary care to the informal caregivers or loved ones who will be taking care of them. And so our goal should be to support patients, even if they're at home, and exploring new models of care that can help do that, I think, is part of what we need to talk about and what I hope this paper will initiate that those types of discussions.
Yes, recently I had an aunt who died at home, and I was there on the last day of her life, and there was a nurse practitioner who came in to see her, and I was able to see that. Other older family members in my family history who've died have all died in the hospital, and so it was interesting to see the different dynamic, you know, with somebody dying in the next room and having a conversation in one's living room about what was happening. It seemed very natural and not unnatural. And I wonder if that will be the experience of more and more people. Hospitals now are being asked not to readmit people within 30 days, especially people on Medicare. Do you think that that has anything to do with the shift that we're seeing?
It's hard to, the question that, you know, you're getting into is the why question. Well, we see this trend. Well, why is it happening? And, you know, I will state off the bat that, you know, our data doesn't help us answer the why question. But there's a, you know, this is an area of work that, you know, a lot has been done. A lot of work has been done in this space. So one of the big reasons I think why more people are dying at home is because of the growth of the hospice movement and now the hospice, you know, industry, if you may. And especially in the United States, where hospice is primarily delivered at home, it's really the main way that a patient can get home support at home through sort of the usual sort of Medicare pathway. A lot of other types of support at home, such as hiring a home health aide or other services, are not covered. So hospice ends up being one of the few consistent ways that a patient who is at the end of life with an expected survival of about 6 months can in fact get help at home. Beyond that, you know, I don't like want to speculate about what other sort of financial drivers may be guiding individual hospitals. But certainly I think that to me, that is probably, even if it is a factor, it's probably a smaller factor. I think another larger factor is how culturally relevant end-of-life care has become, how many more Americans are now thinking about, you know, how they would like to die, more so than we have at any other previous time in our history. I mean, just, you know, many people, it used to be thought, just the mere, just talking about death was thought to be a bad omen. And yet now, you know, families are openly talking about this. Books are being written by authors that are, you know, talking about these issues. And frankly, one of the reasons that we fear death so much in modern times is because of it's become so foreign by being moved to the hospital. And yet I think the fact that now deaths are happening more at home, such as your own experience, actually shows that maybe that will also help normalize that experience and make it a human experience rather than a medical experience that it has become.
And so if you could talk to a trainee, and you do probably all the time, but to our listeners out there, how would you advise that they might have the conversation with their patients when near death?
So this is a very important question, and thank you for asking it. You know, I think in our current era of training, where, you know, things like palliative care have become mainstream, I think we do a much better job of training our trainees. As you know, I was trained. I was a resident not too long ago. I was a fellow just a few months ago. That, you know, we're trained to elicit treatment preferences from our patients. So we ask, you know, routinely ask our patients if they would like to be resuscitated with CPR, or if they would like to, if they prefer to have a breathing machine connected to them if needed. And I would advise that trainees also need to start asking about this question as well, about where patients would like to die. Because the one thing that we do know is not everyone wants to die at home. There are some patients who actually prefer the more controlled setting that is presented in a hospital. Some patients may not want to burden their caregivers if they're very symptomatic or if they have a lot of needs. So I think this question needs to be now incorporated into these conversations that we're now having, you know, very frequently with many of our patients with chronic serious illnesses. Because for many patients, this is actually, and I've seen this, is one of the most important things, and is a question that actually can get missed because of our focus on some other things. So I would encourage trainees to, who are already having these difficult conversations, to make this a part of the things they talk about.
As a point of historical interest, 30 years ago, Frederick Wiseman, and you may be familiar with this, had a 6-hour documentary called Near Death. Mm-hmm. And it was filmed at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. And it was about patients there in the medical ICU and their interactions with staff. And the thing that impressed me, and I saw it probably 25 years ago, the thing that impressed me was the youth of the people, of the clinicians who were caring for these patients, and the kinds of conversations that they were forced to have with family and with the patients themselves. And it elicited, I think, a lot of wisdom from those young people, whether they wanted to have that wisdom or not. And so I would, I should put a link to that documentary as well as to your book, at the end of the podcast.
So I think your observation that many of the physicians who are talking about some of these issues around life and death are incredibly young. In fact, you know, when I wrote the book Modern Death, I was 28, 29 years old myself. And many times I'm in family meetings where I am the youngest person there. And I haven't had the similar type of life experience that many of my patients have had, many of their caregivers have had, and yet they look to us physicians and nurses for answers, because death has become such a medicalized and complex phenomenon that so much of what they knew about what it takes to live and die has become so foreign to them. So you know, I think that young people do have a fresh way of looking at things, and I think that I'm really encouraged by young physicians because they have adopted so many of these new aspects of patient-centered care, such as palliative care, so quickly because it, you know, it resonates with them so much. So I'm encouraged actually by that, but also I think that that we really need to push this forward. I think this is an incredibly complex space. We can look at it both ways. We can look at more people dying at home as a good thing, but also as a point of concern about what are the factors that are driving this movement, and are we doing a good enough job of supporting them in a place outside of the hospital, which traditionally, if you look at how our healthcare system is designed, is just not well equipped to do that.
I want to thank you very much for talking with me today, Dr. Warish.
Thank you so much.
That was our 246th episode, all of them available free and searchable at podcasts.jwatch.org. I'd love your ideas on how to improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from the NEJM Group. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.